Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heavy Pod is Heavy Cast episode. Eden claims it's 209. I don't know. I can't look it up on the website because
the website doesn't exist.
Yep.
I'm famously very good at remembering the episode number, so yeah. I'm sure it's fine.
I trust you implicitly.
I mean, we're just being lazy. We could check it on iTunes or whatever.
Yeah, I know.
It's a cool program. Have you heard of it?
No, I have not. Please tell me more.
Oh, surprising.
Okay. So, hi. I guess if you're hearing this, you're seeing the awesome new website. I'm sure it's good. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure Eden won't make any catastrophically bad decisions regarding anything.
The graphic design. Regarding websites specifically, like I'm famous at not crashing the blog's website. to be fair, that wasn't anyone's fault. That wasn't like something that I specifically or anyone else did, right?
I think some of the stuff can be blamed on implicitly on Kyle, because one of the first crashes we had was because of this photo plugin that we installed because of like the photos that Kyle wanted to do for his live show stuff. Hi, Kyle. I don't know. He's not listening, but... And it was like a really heavyweight plugin, and it was based like the problem is like our blog is huge, right? We've been posting massive. A lot for like 10 plus years, and like plugins that work for small blogs don't necessarily work the same way for us. Like these plugins don't scale, and sometimes when you install a plugin that like queries all the posts ever made every single time somebody looks at it, maybe it doesn't work well.
I mean, I'm sure this is fascinating to the listeners because users famously love backend. It's like the number one thing that they love. But the move that we made now is to try to find a theme that has most of these capabilities already baked into it so that we don't need plugins.
So that if something goes wrong, there's no way for us to do anything about it because it's in the theme. It's not even a plugin we can disable.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, so it's a complete black box, and then we move away from what little insight WordPress gives us. No, but being serious, so that we don't like install stuff that is out of date and gets outdated, and no one remembers what it even does and shit like that. But I won't pretend it's like a back-end change. Mainly, we just wanted to rebrand the site and also get something that fits our new posting format. The podcast is going to stay the same, by the way, but... most of the rest of our content is going to be like monthly from now on.
Yeah. As for the podcast, you know, I mean, you say it's going to stay the same, but like that implies that it will keep any consistent level of quality.
I mean, look, in the past, like this, like the blog shutdown aside, for the past few months, we've been pretty consistent, I think. At least when you compare
it
to like.
Consistently, like every 2 weeks.
Yeah. That's okay. That's fine. That's good. It doesn't matter if it's like every 2 weeks or not. I mean, compare it to, what was it, 2017, when I was flying all over the world all the time and I would miss like every other episode. And it was barely like, I was barely a co-host. Like Cody was on more episodes than I was back then. I think we're doing pretty well right now. I mean, the content is still shit, but you get the shit content in like,
you get what you pay for.
Yeah, exactly. Which is nothing.
Yes. Speaking of getting what you pay for, actually, this is something that breaks that, which is Trivium just yesterday did another live show, this time on Matt's Twitch channel. They got 20,000 viewers, and this was basically them just in their old practice space. Like, they've been, you know, in this practice space that they've been in for years, and they just did deep cuts. Like, previously, the paid-for show they did was, like, a high production value thing, and they did more kind of... popular songs. This one is just all deep cuts, and it was great. I thought it was like better than the other show because, first of all, there was audience interaction. Like, they were interacting with Twitch chat. And the songs were like more to my liking, obviously. And like, it was a really good experience. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And they said that they're going to do more shows, and they said that they're going to like more of both type of shows. They're just, you know, keeping it fresh. And I loved it. So you can go check this out on Matt's Twitch channel on the VOD, and it was good. Yeah. And
I think it's a really cool idea. I think it's a really cool concept, both because you know, you get to please like old school fans like you, like number one Trivium fan on this planet, probably. But also you get to expose people that might have become familiar with you based on your latest albums, which were massive for Trivium, right?
Yeah.
The last two releases, I think, exposed them to a bunch of people who were unaware of them before that. So it's a really cool way to both appeal to veterans, but also expose newcomers to some of your older stuff, stuff that you don't, might not get the chance to play live. And I think the last bit of this is that it's fun for the band, right? Like, yeah, it's a cool opportunity to play stuff that they don't usually get to play.
Yep. And also, like, the audience interaction gives you some fun moments because, so on like Callisto to a Star in Heaven, the chorus goes like, hate not the flesh that makes me, but like the enunciation on the album, like there's a fandom meme that thinks like that says like, sounds like big nut instead of hate not. And like the chat was just spamming big nut, big nut, big nut through the entire song. And the band seeing the chat, they were just like trying so hard not to laugh. And after the song, they just like had to take a break, just keep laughing. It was cool. Like they said that even for like big production things next, that they're going to do like a more fan interaction type of thing. That was cool.
Yeah. That reminds me of the time that I think I've told this story on the cast before, that Opeth played Israel for like the fifth time or something, and they switched from, I don't remember, like a heavy track like Heir Apparent or Orchid or whatever to Windowpane.
Mm-hmm.
And Mikael forgot that he had the guitar pick in his mouth. And he starts singing and he starts choking on the guitar pick. And then he went into this, you know, like this mode where he couldn't stop laughing, and they had to like restart Windowpane four times. And it's such a depressing song, but Mikael can't stop laughing. Every time he starts to sing, he remembers he had the pick in his mouth. It was hilarious. Hilarious.
By the way, another thing that Trivium did was, they covered Swing Over the Axe by Power Trip as a tribute.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a good segue.
Yeah. So you take it, I think.
Yeah. Unfortunately, on Thursday, Riley Gale, the vocalist for Power Trip, passed away.
Yep.
He was 34 years old, which is, I'll be 34 soon, like in May, which is just crazy to think about and so tragic. I actually guested on an Israeli radio show today that we're doing a tribute for Riley. They kind of recorded me talking about Power Trip and their meaning and why they're important. And I said a few things which I think are interesting for our listeners as well. One, like the fucking reach these guys had. So there's like the, you know, the raw, dry data of they were on Billboard and they're very popular and so on. But also Riley himself was, he collaborated with Body Count, right? Ice-T shouted him out. People from all across of the, like, the journalistic spectrum, small blogs that pride themselves on being niche and esoteric, they love Power Trip. Huge publications like Rolling Stone and Metal Sucks and stuff like that, they love Power Trip. People in the middle of that, it's just such a wide net that this band had cast.
Yeah, we love Power Trip, and we always like decry journal core. But yeah, journals love Power Trip as well. It was like, you know, cross-cutting.
Yeah, so I think that's the second point is, like, on paper, Power Trip were like classic journal core, right? It's a throwback kind of sound to the crossover thrash of the late 80s. The aesthetic on the album cover, the song names, but there was something about Power Trip that transcended, right, retro or throwback or revival, all those names for nostalgia, basically, right? There was something. Yeah. Much more essential.
And also, like, the sound was, like, pretty straightforward, right? There wasn't anything that is, like, super mind-blowing about them, and yet, like, somehow there's something appealing to it.
Yeah, I think it's a lot because of Riley, right? And his passion and his charisma really elevated it. And you could see that, and that's the third point, in his politics, right? Like, they were so... I hope the band still exists, right? I hope they can move past this, but Riley especially... From Dallas, Texas, right? A working man. They're all working, people, right? He had a working man style of humor and expression. He wasn't like this, you know, East Coast, you know, sophisticated, went to Berkeley. Not that those people are bad, right? But like
liberal elite.
Yeah, exactly. He was someone who was, you know, from Dallas and had, you know, that mannerism about him was very much of just a guy. And yet they were explicitly leftist, explicitly progressive, explicitly militant about their progressivism. Like the track that Trivium covered, Swing of the Axe, Executioner's Tax, Swing of the Axe, right? It's all about like how, you know, taxes are bullshit and tools for the rich to oppress the poor. And they had a lot of other tracks about, you know, waking up and realizing that we have nothing to lose but our chains. So I think when you add all of those things together, you really get a once in a generation sort of event. And Riley was the fuel behind it in many ways, like his charisma on stage, his charisma in interviews, his guest spots. It's a massive loss. It's like hard to overstate how much of a massive loss this is. And we don't know right now what happened, and we don't expect to know, right? This is like,
yeah, we don't need to know, I think.
Yeah, exactly. We don't need to know. This is private moment, and as much as we're suffering from this loss, his family and friends are suffering like a millionfold. So yep. I've already seen people like asking me, do you know what happened? Are there rumors? Blah, blah, blah. It's like, guys, just don't do that. It's not our moment. It's not our time. There's a lot of people in mourning right now. And, I think we need to respect that. And yeah, it sucks. It's just a huge, huge loss.
Yep. Nothing else to say, really.
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking of JournoCore, so there's a new Mastodon song. Well, actually, there's a new Bill and Ted movie. That's the headline here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as such, there's a new song for the soundtrack of the movie by Mastodon. There's one by Lamb of God. There's one by Tosin Abasi. And a few others that I care less about. Let me look up the soundtrack.
I'll say in the meantime, maybe that it's like, it's cool they updated the contributing artists.
Yeah.
And they like,
and not
they said
like fucking Motley Crue or some shit like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Bill and Ted are about the music that is currently like rock and roll and what rock and roll is currently doing and how awesome it is. So it would have felt, I think, very lame to go back and do like 80s bands or whatever. And I really love that they updated it and got these guys. And also, like, as a side note, all of the air guitar riffs and licks that the guys play, they're all done by Tosin Abasi. So when you hear them like shredding and there's that like the twinge in the background, it's actually Tosin, like, you know, going crazy on the guitar, which is, it's just a cool touch, and it's really awesome.
And I haven't seen the movie, but apparently it's not awful. Like, I mean, the reviews are not great, but the reception seems good.
I mean, come on, when you didn't expect the reviews for Bill and Ted 3 to be good, right?
Yeah,
it's not,
sure.
It's not the point of the movie.
But at least it's not like, you know, it could have been
a disaster.
A disaster, and it's not, right? It's like, okay, yeah, Anchorman 2, for example, like, okay, Anchorman is not like a retro revival per se, but it was not good. It like, but, and what were some other, like, this type of revivals that were just, like, bad? I can't remember right now.
Oh, they were so bad that we can't remember, right?
Yeah.
But there was a bunch of them.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'll check it out, but the soundtrack seems cool. I mean, the mix on the soundtrack is a little bit odd. It feels like it's not been mixed by like a metal guy.
And also maybe mixed for the audience, right? Like mixed for people watching a movie, supposedly in cinemas, although that's not a thing.
Well, Christopher Nolan seems to disagree.
Oh my God, don't even get me started. Fucking Luddite piece of shit. Actually, the Luddites were good. He's just like a conservative asshole. Anyway, the track is called Rufus Lives, and I kind of like it. I do agree. The mix is like flat, right? It sounds like distant and kind of lacks any depth to it, but the song itself is cool. It's kind of like older Mastodon a bit. Has that like Blood Mountain edge to it almost.
But also has some of the good Emperor of Sand like weirdness to it as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I really like this track, and I know they wrote this for this, and it's going to come out on like a rarities album or whatever on September 11th, but I really hope it indicates that they're experimenting with this kind of vibe again. Because if you take the good stuff from Emperor of Sand,
which
you
marry it, like, you know, it's their best album.
Yeah, best album. Yeah, no, we've established that in the podcast lore. We've established that Emperor of Sand is the best album. But if they take the good stuff from Emperor of Sand and like marry it to more aggressive old school Mastodon stuff, that might be a really, really fantastic album. So, yeah. It's probably not going to happen, but let me have my dreams.
No, I think there's a... I mean, the other single they released recently, Light the Torch or whatever it was called, that was pretty cool too. So yeah. I think we're looking at a potentially interesting Mastodon album again.
Yeah. I mean, it won't be their best because that's
Emperor of Sand, of course. I mean, like, that's, you know, agreed upon fact universally.
For sure. For sure. Within the heavy pod universe, cinematic universe.
Okay. So... what else? Let's see. Where do we segue from this? So, speaking of Mastodon, you know what's a good segue from Mastodon?
What?
I don't...
oh, I don't know. We can do Enslaved. Yes. It has, like, psychedelic vibes.
Psychedelic vibes and, like, you know, kind of older Gen X vibes.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's... they wrote about... so, there's a new single called... oh, God.
Uriutun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the original Jotun, the original giant.
Yeah.
And they said that this is like their love letter to krautrock, which mm-hmm. was a huge influence on them when they were growing up and making music. And you can hear it. Like, the main riff is very krautrocky. Yeah. But then after like the 2-minute mark, like the middle of the track, the black metal vocals kind of come back. And the mix between that and the trippy synths on this track that open it works really fucking well. And the video is like perfect. Weird neon pink vibes, like post-apocalyptic storytelling, just works really well. And I think what also works really well is that the track is short, so yeah. It doesn't lose steam and it doesn't like rehash its ideas. I'm so fucking hyped for this album.
Yeah, like the E was kind of, you know, cool, you got your Opeth 70s thing going, but
yeah,
now it's like, all right, now this is some like real ass experimentation. Like, the songs that we've heard so far are all like just super different, and it's, you know, Enslaved, this is what they're like fucking 20 of them or some shit like that.
yeah, and they're still,
I think,
pushing.
It's like 14 or 15 if I remember correctly. And they're still like doing interesting stuff. They're still kind of making good music, and their live stuff is like still tight. Like, this band is just like, why are they so good?
And I think it's interesting because they're underrated in that way. Like, if you ask people for the all-time greatest metal bands, or like for the last 20 years, mm-hmm. you know, people will say Mastodon, Meshuggah, Gojira, stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Or even, let's narrow it down, like the past 15 years, right?
Yeah.
And not many people will say Enslaved. And I think that's bullshit. I think they definitely belong up there as one of the greatest metal bands of the post 2000 years.
Yeah.
You know, when the world started going to shit, basically.
Yeah, everything was fine before glitching. Then. There were no problems before 2000.
Yeah, no, especially not in like 1939. That was nothing happened then.
Okay. So Enslaved, check it out. When is this album coming out? Was it Utgard the name of the album?
Yeah, was it like the end of this month or something
October 2nd. So yeah, the end of this month, more or less.
Yeah, basically. Speaking of Opeth.
Yeah, so there's this... I'm kind of reticent to mention this, but...
oh, come on!
So there's this band called The Reticent. And that's the joke, right? Let me explain the humor to you, my friend.
That
Where are these guys from?
Funnier, famously.
Are they American? Good question. Anyway, who cares? So I just want to mention one thing. This song is called Stage 2, The Captive. And if you go to the YouTube video, it's like hashtag Alzheimer's. It's just kind of like the video has hashtags. Like hashtag The Reticent, hashtag Alzheimer's, hashtag prog metal. I mean, the song is clearly about Alzheimer's. And maybe it's like a concept album about Alzheimer's as a whole. I don't know. It's kind of weird.
It comes off as a bit tone deaf.
That being said, the song is really good.
I think they're American, by the way. This album was produced by Jamie King.
Yeah. So apparently, the album is like a concept album about the seven stages of Alzheimer's disease. So yeah, this tragic bit of progressive storytelling will be coming to you in early 2010. God. okay, I don't want to dunk on this. This is cool. This is literally just Opeth. And like Opeth circa like, what's the album before Watershed? The Grand Conjuration? No, that's the name of the song.
Yeah, Ghost Reveries.
Ghost Reveries, thanks. Yeah, it's like Opeth circa that, I think. And it's like really fucking that. Like,
yeah, it's when the instruments will just blink, because the first 30 seconds or 40 seconds is just instruments.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, this is pretty Opeth. But then the guy started singing.
Yeah.
And like, just Mikael Åkerfeldt, like the Tom. And this is not a knock on him.
Yeah.
Like, being compared to Mikael Åkerfeldt is a big compliment. Like, he's one of the metal's best vocalists. And this sounds really fucking good. And then in the middle, there's like a quieter part. And then instead of having like the, you know, the creepy Opeth mood, like in Beneath the Mire, for example, or a 70s throwback thing, you have saxophone, which is actually composed and written for the track, unlike most metal bands, where it's just like, okay, pause every single idea that was on the track, do a saxophone solo, and then get back to the track. here it's like more organic. I enjoyed it. I really think this would be like more of better on the album kind of thing. Because the album seems to be one cohesive unit. But even as a standalone track, I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was cool. And I want to hear more. Like, somebody's got to do this. Opeth ain't doing it. So
exactly. I was going to say, it's not like we have Opeth to keep doing this. And I think at this point, if anybody has like an ember of hope that Opeth is going to go back.
That ember should become an inferno.
Okay. I mean, I liked the previous album. And even if you didn't like it, I think you can agree that it was
the album
after In Cauda.
Oh, that one. That one.
Yeah. It was better. It was better than the previous
one. No. I'm not dunking on the album. The name.
The name is stupid, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. If you like Opeth, like I said, Opeth aren't doing it, so might as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of Nordic progressive metal, this is a dank one, I guess. Yeah. So, you know, Isan was doing his like two EPs thing. The first one, I don't remember the name of. The second one is Pharos. And that EP is already out, but there's now a music video for this track called Manhattan Skyline, which is a cover of famous Norwegian band A-ha. I know that it's like, did you know that A-ha had songs other than Take On Me?
if Isan lied to us, and just invented a track and said it was from A-ha, would any of us know the difference?
No.
I think what I like about this, first of all, it's nice to see him, you know, being playful and doing stuff that is not, you know, something you would expect from Isan. But Einar is like the perfect.
Einar is in his like leprous costume.
Yeah, his like live gear that he played, the tie and the vest and whatever. Yeah. But I also think, like, Einar, okay, he chose Einar because they're family members, okay? Yes. Let's not kid ourselves. And they live, like, nearby, and they've collaborated in the past. But also, Einar Solberg's voice is perfect to cover A-ha.
Yep.
And now I kind of want to hear, like, a cover album with Einar Solberg singing A-ha songs. I mean, apparently they have more than one.
They should just do fucking Take On Me. Like, stop being teases about it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of coy to do an A-ha track that is not Take On Me, but that was the point, right? He's not going to do the obvious one. He has to be special. The video is corny as fuck. It is so corny.
I mean, but he sounds a corny ass dude.
Yeah, he's corny. He has like the, what is it? Is this a Strat? The pink Strat?
It's a Telecaster.
Like, Telecaster, yeah. He's playing it. Like the dawn in the back. It's just so cringy.
Sunglasses.
Yeah, sunglasses and a little man bun. It's like, if this was anybody else, it would be cringe. But with him, it's like, okay, it's Isan. He's like cheesy dad, right? That's kind of his thing right now. I mean, the cover's fine. I haven't heard the original in my life because I didn't know it existed. I bet it's like one guy listening to us is like a huge A-ha fan, and he's like foaming at the mouth right now. I'm kidding. No one listens to this podcast. So.
And no one listens to A-ha songs.
Is it like an empty set which contains itself? You know, people who listen to this podcast and people that love A-ha?
Sure.
But then is it the same set or a separate set, even though they're both empty?
I don't know, man.
You're the math guy. This is your bread and butter.
Yeah.
No stupid
problems. 2 + 2 = 4 - 1 = 3. Quick maths.
Quick maths. Yeah. I mean, you've taken a hit recently with Nathan Robinson saying that the trolley problem is for dicks, basically.
Oh my fucking god. Don't get me started on that.
For psychopaths.
Nobody knows what we're talking about right now.
Yeah. Speaking of weird guys, Devin Townsend.
Oh yeah.
The OG weird guy posted a live song of Genesis from his Empath album. He's gearing up for a release called Order of Magnitude, Empath Live Volume 1, implying a Volume 2. And it's fucking great. I mean, Empath is not... I liked it. It's not my favorite Devin release. I think it's better than a lot of the stuff that he did, you know, Sky and all that stuff. And what was the one with the cringy Hindu cover art? This one was better. But even though it's not my favorite, this live rendition is just so much fun. It's so cool seeing, you know, the video art and everyone on stage. There's so many people on stage. Che, the vocalist who does Casualties of Cool with him, she's there. There's a choir, multiple guitarists, a drummer, just a whole set. It's really, really nice, and it sounds great. Right, like Devin's live sound is so much fun. And yeah, I really enjoyed watching it. The audience participation is awesome. It's pretty cool. I'm not gonna buy the live album because I've never liked live albums. But if you're a super fan, this is probably a really cool stuff. He's doing it on like Blu-ray and DVD and whatever.
Yep.
And vinyl, everything.
Yeah, Devin Townsend.
Yeah, that says it all, doesn't it? Or does it?
Speaking of Devin Townsend, you know what song is inspired by Devin Townsend?
Which song?
Legacy on the new Unleash the Archers album.
I confirmed
that with Brittany.
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of Devin on this album, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That song specifically.
God, I have it like paused on my player before we started recording. That was the song I was listening to. Abyss is so fucking good. It's so good. I mean, I'm semi-review it for the blog. It's my editor's pick for this month.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so fucking good. And like in that pick, what I want to call out is Carry the Flame, the track before the last, that is just 80s tinged cliche power metal ballad. And it works so well. I don't know who is singing on that track besides Britney. Is it their guitarist or like someone else? It doesn't have a featured like.
Yeah, I think it's probably their guitarist.
Yeah, he does such a fucking good job, and their duets work really well. And in general, like, I loved the previous album, but this is a whole nother level of greatness for them. Like, the death metal influences, the progressive stuff, the Devin influences, all this stuff really comes together to make such a good album. Faster Than Light and The Wind That Shapes the Land and Abyss itself, like classic Unleash the Archers tracks, and I think this will go down as like a classic power metal album. And I know the competition isn't stiff, but that's it. That's the post. It's so fucking good.
I actually like the previous album a little bit more, just because it's a little bit heavier, so it's like more my style. But this one is really good too.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, like that I bet that you prefer the previous one, which is totally legit. It's a great album. But I think this was like, if I would order custom-made an Unleash the Archers album, this is what it would sound like, right?
Yeah.
And as Brittany also wrote in the Anatomy of post that we ran on the blog, Angra and the album Temple of Shadows, which is my favorite progressive power metal album of all time, is a huge influence on the writing, and you can really, really tell on this album. A lot of the riffs and vocal ideas come from there. So again, it's like I custom ordered this album. It's fantastic.
Yep. I'm waiting for the new Immortal Guardian album. Like, when is that one coming out?
Oh my god, I need that. We should check. We should message them and be like, hey guys,
where's the album? The album.
Give us harder. The album now. We know there's like a plague and economic depression, but we don't give a shit. Just give us the album.
Yeah. You know, Immortal Guardians, Gabriel was... Oh, just found a Facebook post saying they wrapped up the new album.
Nice.
So hopefully the announcement is coming soon. You know, Gabriel from Immortal Guardian was on the podcast. But you know who else was on the podcast?
Lots of people.
Along with Brittany from Unleashed Archers. We had Max Phelps from Exist on the podcast.
Right. Yeah, that was a while ago now.
Yeah, when the previous album came out, So Good, So What. So they have a new album out this week called Egoista, and it's super good. Have you had a chance to listen to it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we spoke about it last time we recorded. That was like 50 years ago, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, we talked about the singles, but now we have the whole album.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a lot more... I think you posted about it in the group.
Yeah.
By the way, we have a Facebook group. Heavy Group is Heavy. You should join.
Facebook is an awesome platform.
Yeah, it's a great platform that doesn't promote hate and like literal murder in any way. Please don't suck us from orbit. The new Exist album, like you said in the group before I derailed us, feels even more of like a cynic continuation.
Yeah.
Or like the cynic album we have always deserved.
Yeah.
It's really good. I think it's more expansive than So True, So What. It feels less claustrophobic. So Good, So True, So What, sorry. It felt on purpose as a good thing, right? Clawing and close and like closing in on you. And here it's a much more, you know, open and expressive sound, which I really love.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, I mean, Max was in Cynic, right? And he was also in Death to All. So like he has the credentials. But I feel like the previous album, their first album, Sunlight, was really cool. It had some weird production, but it had some interesting, like, jazzy style ideas. Then the second one kind of didn't go in that direction. It kind of went in, like, a kind of a weirder direction. But this one, like, comes back full circle and, like, takes all of that stuff and just takes it to what I feel is, like, a next level. And, you know, I feel like this is where their sound and also Cynic's sound was always meant to go. So it's like a really satisfying album in that sense.
And I want to call out two things. Well, three things. One, I want to call out myself for saying So True, So What when the album is called So True, So Bound. Jesus Christ.
I got it wrong either. So
yeah, whatever. Let me like self-deprecate. And then the two other things I want to call out is that the drums on this album were recorded and engineered and produced with Anoop. Sastry. And also performed by him, I think. Like, he does the drums on this album. And then the vocals were recorded, engineered, and produced with Mike Semsky.
Oh.
So those are, like, two names from a different era of Heavy Blog, right?
I mean, it makes sense. Max is from Baltimore, Mike's from Baltimore, Anoop's from Baltimore.
Yeah, and I think they did a good job. Like, the production on both the vocals and the drums sounds really good, which is super cool. I was just scrolling and looking at the list, and like, those are names I haven't heard in a while, and I wouldn't have expected to see them here, and yet here they are.
Anoop has been doing a lot of stuff lately. I remember seeing him on like something else as well. I forget.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
But he's like all over the place.
No, for sure. I mean, this is their job, right? They're hardworking people. It's just like hasn't crossed our paths.
Yeah.
Well, in 2014, those were like two names that we would constantly post about, and now it's like it's funny how these things shift and change.
Yeah.
Anyway, this album is fucking great.
Yep. So speaking of like fucking the Mid-Atlantic area.
Yeah.
So there's a new Tala album. So coming up. So Tala, what's Tala? What the fuck are we talking about here? So there's this guy, Justin Bonitz. He's been doing stuff on YouTube for a long, long time. We talked about his stuff like years ago on the podcast. He had like a solo project called Hungry Lights, and it was just this like weird Coheed style thing. hard to explain. But
well,
like,
well articulated though, Noyan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. It's like a prog rock, prog metal thing that like he had like four or five concept albums. He's just kind of a weird guy. Over the past couple of years, like he's kind of formed a band called Tala. T T-A-L-L-A-H, with none other than the son of Mike Portnoy, Max Portnoy. Yep. And they've been doing stuff. I wasn't really into their stuff, but like recently they put out a single called Overconfidence, and I really enjoyed it, so I wanted to share it. And so this is basically, I mean, they've kind of been like a nu metal-ish band, but they've kind of had like a weird sound, so it's kind of hard to, you know, nail them down. But this song is just like straight up very Slipknot in a very good way. And and then I, you know, listened to some of the other songs from this album, and it's really cool. The thing with this guy is that he has like a really kind of emotive vocal style. Like he just does all kinds of things, like, you know, screaming, low lows, singing, like singing in a way that's like very Corey Taylor, like, you know, very kind of rip my throat out style of singing. Like he just does a lot of stuff, and it works really well in nu metal context. Like, you know, when we had Ryan and we did the nu metal podcast, it was, you know, the point we made was like nu metal is like everything goes. So, and this is like everything. So that's a good fit, and it's an interesting, album. And I feel like we're, for the past few months, we've had like more and more interesting nu metal stuff going on, which makes me happy.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I like this track. Again, this is not my favorite style of music.
Yeah.
But it's well made. I think alongside the Slipknot, there's some core in here as well.
Yeah.
Especially on the bass, and also the aesthetics of the music video are very metal, and specifically Korn. It's cool. I like it because it's obvious that these guys, you know, they like the genre. They understand what it's about. It's not just a rehash or a retread. It's like their own take on it. The production is great. A lot of the my problem with these like nu metal throwback albums is that they sound like trash.
Yeah.
A lot of the times, and it's not the case here. This sounds quite good. So yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. The album Matrifagy is a concept album. Cool concept, but anyway, check it out. It's coming out soon, I think, so it'll be interesting. Speaking of nu metal, there is a new DVSR album, Divisor. Is that what we call
Divisor.
It? And it's super, super good. It's called West Technique, I think. They're an Australian nu metal band, and I've listened to some of their singles before, and the kind of I always felt like they were like kind of there, but not all the way there. But this album was like all the way there, and it's really, really good. If you were gonna listen to like one track from it, I would say probably like No Sugar. The opening track is like really strong. But yeah, I'm really happy that we're having some like actually legit good nu metal stuff now. I feel like this one kind of, you know, does a good job of. Remember, like way back, we talked about how like interesting things to do with nu metal now are like instead of like redoing like the old styles of rap and like blending that with like djent, this one is like actually, you know, takes modern hip-hop styles and does it with like good production, and yeah, it's good. And them being Australian, they have CJ from Thy Art Is Murder on one of the songs,
on Bloodlust. I think, like we said last time we were talking about this, what I like about Divisor and specifically this album is their flow, not in the rap sense, right, but just in the way that the album doesn't stop. It doesn't have those, you know, like weird ambient passages that don't really fit and just are meant to be edgy. It just goes, right? Which is not to say it doesn't have like more mellow tracks, because it does have a few, but mostly just because of structure and composition, it just goes. And that's what you want from nu metal, right? You're here for the vibe, the energy, the kick. And this album does it really well. And it, again, like going back, like with Tala, it just shows that you don't have to retread. You can take the sound, make it your own, add in some stuff that you like, some techniques that you like, maybe a West technique. I'm sorry, I hate myself. and something cool comes out at the other end. So yeah, this is a cool album as well, for sure.
Speaking of young bands, there is a new song by Unprocessed featuring Polyphia.
I think
Unprocessed are like super, super good, and they are like poised to do great things. And I think collabing with Polyphia, you know, shows how far they've come and how far they can go.
For sure.
This song go ahead.
I was just going to say that it's been a while since this song was released. It was like in July 17. We just kind of missed it.
Yeah.
And I think I want to take like the blame for that because I have an allergic reaction to Polyphia. Yeah. Like, I can't fault them for their musicianship. They're obviously like super talented guitar players, but one, their aesthetics just cause me to break out in hives, whether it's like the sexism on the videos like Champagne, where they just literally had models hanging around, you know, touching them and it was weird, to their like rich boy fashion aesthetics and custom guitars and sorry, but Hitler Youth haircuts and all that shit. I can't stand them and I don't like the music. The music is, you know, you have that thing where you don't like the saccharine, like very chromatic tone. I'm okay with it, but Polyphia take it to like a whole new levels, right? Of cloying sweetness.
But I like unprocessed too much.
Yeah, exactly. So I also love unprocessed, and for weeks I didn't listen to this and I was like, okay, fuck it. Unprocessed are cool. I know they're a good band. Let's hear what this sounds like. And it's actually really fucking good. And I think it actually makes my point about Polyphia for me. When you take the basic formula and their talent and you meld it with a band that are more grounded and varied and less, you know, well, not monochrome because it's the opposite of that in their style, but less like one trick pony.
Yeah.
You get something super interesting. I do not like the video that's like basically unprocessed doing Polyphia in like the aesthetic. But the track itself is just fucking awesome. It's so fun to listen to. It is again very sweet and buoyant and stuff like that, but it's actually done well here.
I'm like, Manuel Gardner Fernandez is just like an incredible guy. Like, he's so good at singing, he's so good at guitar, like, and like his writing is so creative. Like, this is just mind-blowing.
And so, and this is a good excuse to go back to the album.
Artificial Void.
What was that, 2018, 2019?
19,
yeah. Fucking incredible album. Very underrated.
Yeah.
I feel like they get unfairly clumped up in the like YouTube guitarist kind of scene.
Yeah.
And I think they're much more than that.
Yeah. Like, the thing that I love about Unprocessed is that like when they go heavy, they go real heavy. And like they, when they go like saccharine, they go in like an interesting direction. And my worry for them is that in subsequent albums, they kind of just go like more and more saccharine and like drop some of the heavy stuff. And it's just kind of become more of a like amorphous blob. But like, if they are able to preserve their heavy sound, it's like, you know, so good.
Yeah, totally. I think their power lies in the contrast, right?
Yes.
Their power lies in the switching back and forth between these two styles. And hopefully they don't suffer from something that I've just invented and is very rude, but I apologize. But I hope they can avoid the Nick Johnstonification that happens to so many of these bands. Like, going back and like listening to what bothers me about a lot of these artists, it's Nick Johnston and his like style of guitar playing, which is very much of that like YouTube guitarist persuasion. It's good within a context.
Yeah.
Right? Within a contrast. So I hope they can maintain that contrast.
Yep. Are we done?
Okay. Do we want to do What's the Face, Era?
Sure, it's okay.
Yeah, I kind of disagree about this specific single. So Era have always been, for me, it's okay. Right? I've always wanted...
Didn't like, they also to collab with Polyphia?
Yeah. I think they did, like, a while ago.
They toured together, but I don't know if they collabed. Anyway.
Anyway. So, it was always, like, to the side. It was... I don't think the composition was as strong. And they had some weird production problems on previous releases. It was always like, okay, yeah, that's cool. But this new one is actually really good. It's called Snowblood. They changed labels.
They used to be on Sumerian, right?
Yeah, they used to be on Sumerian. Now they're on a label called UNFD, which is apparently pretty large in like Australia and that market. And this also, like, it sounds like Era, but it feels a lot more essential and it has that contrast. I think the clean vocals work really, really well on this track and like create that tension that I was missing from their previous work. Cause it would always be like, a riff, and then that riff again and again, and it kind of lost its luster. But here they experiment a bit more with the track structure, and I think the clean vocals do a really good job of keeping it fresh. So
just
I like
you're
it.
Allergic to Polyphia Core. I'm allergic to like Periphery yeah. Core.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. I totally get it. And this is just one single. I don't know if the new album will be good. That's always been the problem, like maintaining my attention across like a whole album. So we'll see. But this new single sounds promising.
Okay.
Cool. You don't have to agree with me, man.
I didn't disagree. I just said, okay.
You don't. It was in your tone, okay?
Okay.
We've been married for long enough. No, I'm joking.
Sure. Okay. Cool.
Cool. This all is right. This is an awkward.
Speaking of being cool people time.
Yeah, let's do it. Lots of stuff.
Yes. So let's do Palm Strings first because we were both like common on that one.
Man, I just had such a good time. Yes. The movie is so if you don't know, it's Andy Samberg and oh god,
Kristen Bellotti.
Yeah. And the premise is what if Groundhog Day, but at this wedding. Fancy wedding in California. And then the twist, and it's the first 5 minutes of the movie, which I really loved, is it's two people, right, stuck in this loop, but one has been stuck in the loop for way longer.
It feels like maybe like thousands of years.
Yeah, basically he's been stuck there for infinity, right?
Yeah.
And you get told the story originally, at least, from the perspective of the person who hasn't been in the loop yet.
Yeah.
Right? And she sees him doing all that thing, all those things that the protagonist does in like Groundhog Day scenarios, like dodging people, perfect timing, always knows what to say, and so on. She's like, oh, that's odd. And they're like romantically involved, and she follows him into the cave that creates this entire thing.
What I like about this one is that, like, it just skips all the foreplay and just gets to the meat of it, right? Like, it doesn't do, like, he's just like, oh, he's, you know, it's one of those time loop scenarios, right? Like, and like, because usually in these types of movies, you see, you know, the protagonist kind of coming to terms with it and slowly discovering and all that stuff. But here it's just like, you know, they know you've already seen this, right? So they're just like, okay, let's cut to the chase. Let's not do the origin story. Let's just do the good stuff. And because, like, you know, but they also still have that little bit of fish out of water because, like, the mother is like, I'm sorry, she's like, she's the mother. You know, right?
Yeah, I know.
Okay. She's the fish out of water, but she's catching up pretty fast. And Andy Samberg's been there, like, so long that he, you know, he acts as, like, the
mentor.
The mentor and the way to kind of skip all of the boring stuff. And also, like, it's really, like, the kind of an angle that you don't necessarily see in these movies is that he's, like, so come to terms with it, right? Like, usually what you get is characters, you know, midway through the movie, they'll start to get kind of into the routine of things. But here it's like he's beyond even that, right? He's just, like, completely given up and just completely embraced his life, and he just doesn't give a fuck. He's not even trying to escape anymore. He's just like, you know, fuck it, this is it, I'll just keep going. I guess.
And I think what informs that is the scale, right? Like, usually, let's say Groundhog Day, how many times does he actually do the loop? Like 50, maybe?
Yeah,
here it's like infinity times. Like, this guy has done it literally tens of thousands of times.
Yeah.
And he's so much on the other side that he, like, he had a stint where he was killing himself, right? But then he realized that pain was real, but he kept going for it because he became like a masochist. And it really shows like the shit you could do when you take it to the extreme, right? And paint with a really broad brush instead of, I mean, I'm not, Groundhog Day is a classic, right?
Yeah.
But when you look at it now, it's like, yeah, okay. So he does a bunch of stuff, but he escapes pretty, pretty fast, right? Here it's like, what if it was torture?
Yeah.
What if you were there for like, so long that he forgets like who he was before the loop, right?
Yep.
And I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it's what you think it is, right? You just get the love conquers all, yada, yada stuff. And it's done well. It just wears its influences and ideas on its sleeves. It's really fun. Andy Samberg is hilarious. Everyone on the cast is really funny. It's feel good. It's really well made. And that's it.
And also, like, all of the hot takes about the movie, you said it's a movie for our current times, right? Like, the whole coronavirus, obviously. You know.
Corona, yeah. Quarantine,
Andy Samberg's, like, he is looking better as he ages.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he looks great. That's true.
I stopped watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, like season 5. I just like, you know, after yeah. this, I just watched all of it. Like, obviously the cop stuff in the show doesn't necessarily hit as well. But like,
yeah.
his style of humor is, you know, he's good. Andy Samberg is actually good. Hot take.
Super hot take, I thought, yeah.
All right. So in the vein of movies, I want to talk about a bit of a weird movie. So this mm-hmm. movie is like hella weird. So it's called Murder Death Koreatown. And it's made by unknown. Like the who made this movie and who's in it is actually not known. It is based on a real murder that happened in LA, I think. But it's a found footage movie that is, you know, spins off from this real murder. And the movie, it's basically shot by one guy. And basically, this guy sees a murder happen in his apartment block in Koreatown. And he's convinced that there's more to the story. First it's like, oh, you know, the guy was like killed over there, but they arrested the like woman who his wife who killed her like over there, and this like, but why is the blood here? And like at first it's like, yeah, okay, that's kind of weird, but then he starts getting like super obsessed with it, like way too obsessed, to the point that it's like affecting his like personal relationships, and like he's like
he
starts,
he goes down the conspiracy rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, he starts bothering people in the area, and then like some weird stuff happens, and like he just keeps going deeper and deeper, and it's basically about the rabbit hole of people who fall into like these conspiracy holes. And I thought it was like really effective in a really original way, because it's like super lo-fi, right? It's literally just shot by one guy with one camera. You never see the guy's face. And there's some spooky stuff going on. And it's basic, like it feels like a creepypasta made into a movie, but it's like a really original way to do this. And actually, I later found out that like a year ago, this was actually a creepypasta. So what they did was they shot the movie and then like released it as a creepypasta. Like there are in the creepypasta, there are like screenshots from the movie itself, like a year before the movie came out. So that's like a weird viral like marketing campaign. It's a very weird movie. It's like very flat, right? It's full of very similitude, right? Because like you can't tell if it's like some of it is like candid footage, some of it isn't. And like there's a lot of footage of like the guy just talking to himself. It's just really unsettling, but also like a really kind of poignant look into the mind of, you know, a guy who goes down a Reddit style conspiracy hole.
Interesting. Have you ever watched the mockumentary they did on M. Night Shyamalan?
No, that sounds interesting.
It's super interesting, and I watched it when I was younger, and it really creeped me out. It's like a mockumentary about M. Night Shyamalan, where the premise is, what if all the shit that M. Night Shyamalan made movies about actually existed and happened to him? And M. Night Shyamalan plays in it himself, right? And it's like this, of like a paparazzi kind of story, right? Like they go too deep, and he's like, get, you know, back off, and suddenly things start to not make sense, like, they discover he drowned when he was 9, like in, what was it, The Village, where someone drowns and comes back. And it's actually quite creepy. Like, they did a really good job of setting it up. I don't remember what it was called. I watched it years ago on, like, late night television or something.
The Buried Secret of M. Night Shyamalan.
Exactly. And it's really well made. And he does a great job there playing. I know he's kind of an asshole, right, as a person, but he does a good job playing an asshole on camera there. Yeah, I need to rewatch it. I remember it was quite good.
All right. So yeah, Murder Death Koreatown. You can find it on like, I think it was on like Amazon Prime or something like that. It's weird. So I've been trying to get you to watch Under the Silver Lake. Which is made by the It Follows director. And Under the Silver Lake is like a high budget, very Hollywood version of this. And this is like a very low budget found footage movie like that.
Well, Ronnie always wants to watch Hall stuff, so I'll just get it and we'll watch it.
I think first watch Under the Silver Lake.
Oh, yeah, no, Under the Silver Lake, I meant, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right, yeah, then you take it away.
Yeah, video games now.
Yes.
I've been playing Dreamscaper.
Is it good?
So it's good. I've been following this game ever since the demo was released, like the first trailer or whatever. It's an indie roguelike where you play...
Wow, what an original premise.
What an original premise. And it's like in not Seattle, the setting. And the idea is that you're playing this woman who you don't know why. She left like the small, you know, Washington state kind of town she lived in and moved into Red Haven, which is like not Seattle. And she's trying to learn her way. And when she sleeps, she remembers like her previous life and slowly unravels the trauma in the middle. So when she sleeps, it's kind of like, you know, like a, not exactly top down, kind of the camera angle is kind of slanted, and you fight monsters with different weapons and magic and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The art style is fantastic. It's like really charming and quintessential. The combat is fine. You know, it's not nothing too innovative. The bosses are really cool and the monsters are cool, like how they tie into the dream. There's also sorts of puzzle mechanics to do with the dream and so on. But the cool thing is when you wake up, if you've done well on this run, you get more time before you need to go back to sleep and you talk to people around town and you get to know them. The more you get to know them and the things that they tell you bleed into the dreams. Right, so she starts dreaming about things that they're talking to her about.
Is it like a choice thing? So like you get to essentially influence the dreams that you have? Or is it like linear?
It's linear. But for example, when you finish an entire part of the run, you can wake up without resetting the run. And you have 3 hours. So going to the cafe costs you 20 minutes. And then talking to this guy, chatting with him, costs you 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And chit-chat like improves your relationship with him by a really small amount, but it gives you clues into the kinds of presents that he would like. And you forge those presents from things you find in the dream. So you can save resources to forge specific things. And depending on like the paths you go down, it opens new abilities, new weapons, new magic and stuff like that. And even though it's early access, there's like 10 different people and they each open like dozens of different equipment. So there's lots and lots of modifications. And the cool thing is you can't choose the things you unlock. They randomly spawn inside the run. Right. So you basically get more and more options that modify your runs. So mm-hmm. It's not groundbreaking. It's not innovative in any way, but the music is great and the writing is really good, like around her trauma and finding your place in a new city. And the gameplay is good enough. Which makes it really nice. So if you like roguelikes and it's not very intense or very difficult, so if you're in the mood for something like that, check this out. I think it's quite good.
All right. So one game that I've been playing is Kill It With Fire,
I've been meaning to check this out.
It's a really interesting thing. So it's basically like Prey 2017, but in like a really small scale. So the premise is that you're like in these, you know, houses and there's spiders everywhere and you're supposed to kill these spiders. How is that like, nothing about that sounds like Prey, right? But basically it's like a super immersive sim style gameplay where, you know, you have a variety of weapons and things, but like also everything in the world you can interact with and like do stuff with. And it's done in like a really interesting fashion. Like, so for example, you know, the objectives that you're given are like, you know, first it's like, okay, kill all the spiders, but like some of them are like in hard to reach places, so you have to like mm-hmm. burn something to like get them to come out and stuff like that. And you know, it keeps getting more and more intricate and more complex, and you have, you know, keep getting a variety of different tools. So for example, you get like Cheetos, which you can drop on the floor, which like attracts the spiders and like they stay there and eat for a bit. So you can go and like, they're basically like vulnerable, right? Because they normally move really fast. But if they finish the Cheeto, they get upgraded to like a higher level of spider and like they become like harder to catch and like all that
yeah.
stuff. Like it's a lot of mechanics essentially, and a lot of interesting ways to deal with those mechanics. So it's like a really cool game of like, small scale immersive sim. Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. It's like really interesting.
Awesome. Yeah, sounds like a lot of fun.
I was just going to ask, like, have you played Wasteland 3? It looks really good.
I haven't played it. I've heard some mixed stuff about it, to be honest. And I'm not sure I'm in the mood for, like, a squad-based, like, turn-based thing. I've been playing a lot of Battle Mech.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's what I'm looking for. But I understand the story here is much more important.
Yeah, it seems like it's a more kind of story campaign-based thing. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I figured it would be up your alley, and I was looking for whether it's good because, like, the setting, the whatnot, looks super interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, my problem is that on Tuesday, Crusader Kings 3 is releasing. Crusader Kings 2 is like one of my most played games of all time, so I don't want to commit to anything right now. Although it might be nice to have something, you know, in parallel to Crusader Kings, which is very different to play. So I might check this out and let you know. Wasteland 2 was really good.
Yeah. And what I've heard is that, you know, this kind of, makes better things that were not super great about 2.
Yeah. I might check it out. It looks interesting for sure.
All right. And do you want to take the last one?
Yeah, so the last one, you actually sent me this. Yep. It's a YouTube channel called Let's Game It Out. And I don't think we're like saying anything new here. It's very popular, has like 1.6 million subscribers or whatever. And what this guy does is basically, he's called Josh. He plays mostly sandbox games like Planet Zoo and Sims and Hydroneer and Satisfactory
Cooking
and all
Simulator.
That stuff. Yeah. Cooking Simulator and Airport Simulator and all that stuff, and he fucks with them.
Yep.
Like, he gets them to crash, he crafts horrible things in-game which, like, destroy the NPC's lives. So I think my favorite one so far is maybe Satisfactory, where he creates, like, he does a tube system, and he finds out that when you exit and enter a tube, it accelerates you. So he builds this, like, basically this huge railgun out of these like tubes, and he launches himself so far that the game like starts to stutter because he was never meant to see all of these like light boxes and shit like that.
Like collisions, he's going so fast that collisions don't work.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Like, the one in Astroneer where he blows up so much dynamite that the game crashes because he basically like blows up the entire universe.
In Sims where he like captures the entire neighborhood in his house and builds like a reverse panopticon.
Yeah, reverse panopticon, and also paints that one guy.
Yeah.
And then displays his, like, paintings of him on the toilet or whatever. He's hilarious. He has a very, like, monotonous style of speaking that gets some time, you need some time to get used to. But once you do, like, I've been obsessively watching his stuff for ever since you. He has a lot. He's been doing this for a long time. I think he's better, like, he's certainly improved in the last year.
Yeah.
I think. And I want him to do more stuff like Satisfactory. I think that was funnier when you have that unbridled freedom of a game like Astroneer or Satisfactory. But still, also his surviving the aftermath stuff is really funny. The Planet Zoo stuff is just hilarious. It's hilarious.
Yeah, the fucking Planet Coaster one where he just like, launches people and collects them and like puts them through hell.
Yeah. I need to watch the original Satisfactory one. I still haven't done it. There's a lot of stuff on his channel that I want to
And
watch,
like, so devs send him like early access version of their games to make videos. They, like, he just like completely destroys the games.
Oh, dude, did you see the one he did for Raft?
Oh yeah, the fucking giant Raft.
Yeah, that was amazing as well. Yeah, he's really, really funny.
I'm surprised some of the things he does like work in these games, and they're just like so ridiculously broken in like ways that are, you know, unpredictable. Yeah. Like, also, like, in one of the cooking simulator videos, like, he figures out a way to go out of bounds in that game, which is like a really kind of sophisticated way. Like, he opens a drawer and like while the drawer opening animation is playing, pulls up his phone and then like moves in a specific way and like does that like three times in a row to go out of bounds. Like, how the fuck do you discover that?
Dude, this guy, he's like the brute force version of YouTubers. He just, I can't do this. What happens if I try for 60 hours?
Yeah.
Right? And then he can do all this shit because he just throws an insane amount of time into it. And I was thinking, you know, that's a lot of time. But then again, he makes a lot of money off of this.
Yeah.
Like, his videos have his Satisfactory one with the cannon that like destroys the game has 9 million views. That's a lot of views for a gaming YouTuber.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like Billie Eilish or whatever. So this is his job. So just like I throw 60 hours into debugging some bullshit JavaScript no one cares about, it takes the same amount of time and like throws it into a game. So why the fuck not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Good talk.
Thanks for listening. Hopefully there's a blog to listen to this on.
Yeah. And if not, you know, whatever. We'll just like throw it out there somewhere into the ether.
We'll post it on fucking Google Wave.
What? What is that?
Google Wave? It's like one of the stuff that they deprecated. It was like a social network before G+.
Do you know why that happens?
What, deprecation?
Yeah. Like why Google have this particular pattern of doing things. So,
oh, because they want the data, right? From the
even
if the experiment fails.
No. Okay. So, okay. So some little inside baseball here. I know a lot of people who work for Google, right? Basically, they have this promotion structure that is like a really aggressive thing to get promoted. You have to do something new and demonstrate that people use it. But there's no promotion in well maintaining an existing product, right? So basically what people do is they just like propose a new product, get it done, make it working, and like demonstrate that people use it. But then they get promoted and like there's nobody left, like it's not sexy to keep working on it anymore. Yeah. There's nobody left to maintain it. And eventually it gets killed off. That's why that happens. Like this is like consensus among Googlers as to why this happens.
Yeah, I mean, capitalism is a meritocracy, right? So this is fine.
Yeah, just now you know, I guess.
Now you know.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.